Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas, Melissa Amarillo. Thanks for being with us, Melissa.
Thanks for having me.
Melissa, can you tell our listeners how you got involved in animal protection?
Yeah, well, I got involved in animal protection because I've been into snakes pretty much my whole life. I decided to go the science research route to do a field in conservation biology that revolved around snakes. And I did that kind of the traditional work of going out and counting, assessing different impacts and how that affected snakes, making recommendations for what would help them. And I did that for about 12 years with my partner that co-founded the organization. And what we kept running into, and other biologists have run into this as well, is that a lot of people don't like snakes. They're scared of them. And this makes it really difficult to implement strategies to promote their conservation, because if people don't like the animal, they don't care if habitat is protected for them. You know, they don't care if that road is going to harm their den or their nest site or whatever. And we realized that none of the big environmental groups were addressing that aspect of snake conservation. Some people included snakes in their conservation work, but not really focused on education. So we decided to shift gears. I switched out of the PhD program into a master's because I didn't need a PhD to found a nonprofit, and decided to form a nonprofit that was focused on changing attitudes towards snakes to make it easier to do conservation.
And you say on your website that you guys follow the guiding principles of compassionate conservation. So can you tell us what you mean by compassionate conservation?
Yeah, so I'm not going to go through the guidelines verbatim because they're kind of long, but in a nutshell, compassionate conservation keeps in mind individual animals instead of just focusing on populations. So traditionally, conservation biology is all about preserving populations because that's the unit that's generally seen as important, and it is the unit that's important as far as preserving a species, is looking at it on a population level. But a lot of the ways in which we study, and sometimes the way in which we implement conservation practices, are harmful to individual animals. So conservation, compassionate conservation, kind of marries animal protection, animal welfare, and animal rights with conservation biology, and we try to do kind of like human medical practitioners, you know, do no harm. So it's the do no harm way of practicing conservation biology and keeping in mind individuals.
Yeah, that sounds like a good way to go forward, especially with snake conservation, because most people encounter snakes as individuals rather than as thinking them as a population, right? You hear about people here on our campus, sometimes at the tailgating parties and stuff, rattlesnakes join the party, and then we have to have one of the local snake researchers here relocates those rattlesnakes. But if he wasn't willing to do that in cooperation with our campus police officers, what would happen is, you know, those snakes would probably be killed because people are afraid of them.
I'm a vegan and an animal rights advocate, and I'm scared of snakes. One of my earliest memories is as a little kid in the woods coming across three rattlesnakes and jumping out of my boots and running away.
But they didn't attack you, right?
No,
they didn't hit you.
But they rattled, and that's a scary sound. And then, of course, many people have the belief that it was a snake who caused mankind's downfall in Genesis. And I don't think that myth will ever be dispelled.
No, that's kind of, you know, I think that, you know, when I am doing my presentations and I'm like, this is a very common fear and a lot of people don't like them. And it makes sense because, yeah, from some of our earliest myths, like the story of the Garden of Eden and snakes kind of ruining it for everyone to, you know, modern day myths and stories, Harry Potter, snakes signified evil, even Indiana Jones is scared of snakes,
The
Jungle Book. I mean, they often show up as villains, and so that's kind of our background, and humans are very much motivated by stories, so we're trying to tell different stories about snakes.
You know, I remember reading something, I think it was by Desmond Morris, some years ago, saying that perhaps this happened because of eels. Because humans might have spent a little time living on the shore or even in the water, and it was eels that we were scared of, because many people think of snakes as slimy, and they aren't.
Huh, that's interesting. I haven't heard that. That does make sense because snakes are not slimy. But humans did evolve in a place with more venomous snakes than we have here in the U.S. So it makes sense that we should be alert to their presence, but that doesn't mean they need to be persecuted and wiped off the face of the earth like a lot of people try to do.
Tell us a little bit about how you go about explaining to people the benefits of having snakes around.
Yeah, so this is something that we do quite differently. So most people that do snake education or mention snakes in their environmental education programs focus on the utility of snakes and how they help people, keeping prey populations in check, that things that we don't like rodents, things that most people don't like. I don't have issues with rodents. but I think that because a lot of the, it's with snakes, it's not that people don't recognize their importance so much, it's that they're scared of them. So it's an emotional thing that we're fighting, and I think that facts can only go so far with most people in fighting an emotional response. So our group fights that with an emotional appeal for conservation. So we use stories, we focus on individual animals, we name them, and we use those stories to illustrate scientific facts about snakes that most people don't know. So we focus on behaviors that aren't talked about much, a lot of people don't know about, and are also things that people like. So we talk about mommy rattlesnakes taking care of the babies, defending them from vicious squirrels that actually do attack and kill rattlesnake babies. And when I can get a room of people like cheering for the rattlesnake against the squirrel, like that's a total win, and it really works. And just giving them a name and telling their story and focusing on the softer side of snakes, that it's all accurate stuff, like it's based on research that I've done or other people have done, that snakes do, and also their social behavior, that they have friends, they have other individuals that they share a den with, that they don't really like to hang out with them. And it very much, it gives them a personality, and it goes a long way to just painting a different picture and getting people to think about them as something other than cold-blooded killers.
Recently, actually, just March 11, 12, and 13, was the Sweetwater Rattlesnake Roundup, which is the world's largest rattlesnake roundup. So let's talk a minute or two about snake roundups.
Describe what one typically is to our listeners and what goes on at these roundups.
Yeah, rattlesnake roundups are events that in a lot of ways are very much like the county fair, that if you grew up in a small town in the United States, you're very familiar with it. The lemonade, the fry bread, the rides, the flea market.
The beer.
The beer. Actually, well, at Sweetwater, there is no beer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was kind of because I needed it. Anyway, the thing that sets rattlesnake roundups apart is that also at these festivals, weeks and months in advance of the event itself, professional hunters go out and they collect unlimited numbers of rattlesnakes. There's no, in any of the states that have rattlesnake roundups, which are Texas, Oklahoma, Georgia, and Alabama, there's no limit to the number that you can catch, and because there are contests for who can bring in the most and the biggest snakes, they very much try to get as many as they can and the biggest, healthiest adults in the population. They keep them often without food or water for those weeks, months leading up to the events, and then at the rattlesnake roundups, they're weighed, they're used in different demonstrations depending on the roundups at Sweetwater. They do a venom extraction demonstration, even though that venom is most likely not used for research or for anti-venom because it's not collected in a very clean and certainly not a sterile environment. They do shows that they claim are to teach about safety around snakes, but then they do things like tease the snakes into striking balloons. Not real sure why that is promoted as safe behavior around rattlesnakes when the thing you want to do is just step away from them, not try to get them to strike balloons. And then sort of the grand finale of all that for the snakes is they slaughter them in public, they hit them in the head with a bolt gun, they chop their head off with a machete, and then they skin them while the bodies are still wriggling in place. And you know, these are things that we do to a lot of animals, but it's normally behind closed doors. And even with some other wildlife species that have similar killing contests like this, they're very secretive. They're not advertised to the public. Often when people find out about them, they are enraged. I mean, you think about every time a Mercy for Animals or PETA releases a video of what happens at a slaughterhouse, people get upset. But these events with snakes happen in public. You can even pay to skin a rattlesnake yourself and add your bloody handprints to this wall, which is covered with the bloody handprints of children, because these are family, I'm sorry, I'm air quoting, which you can't see on the radio. These are family-friendly events, and people that live in these areas, like, grew up with them, and they've been doing it since they were little. So they're pretty horrific on a number of levels. I mean, the unlimited take of a wildlife species without any sort of, you know, statewide monitoring or any even population-level monitoring to make sure that they're not damaging those populations. I mean, you know, they kind of tell the story that, well, we've been taking in thousands of snakes every year for so many years, so it's fine. But
it's tradition.
You know, once upon a time, we said that about passenger pigeons, and then all of a sudden they were gone.
Or many other species that we could name, too. And people are just not coming to grips with how their exploitation of animals affects natural populations.
There's so many other little things about the Sweetwater event that bother me. Like, there's a gun and knife show, and there's a Miss Snake Charmer pageant. it's, you know, it's kind of scary that people participate in things like this.
It is, and it's, people are starting to identify, you know, health problems and other, and obviously, like, our attitudes towards the environment affected by something that's called nature deficit disorder, which has to do with, you know, kids not getting outside, not playing in nature, not developing that love of their environment that a lot of us grew up with just because we played outside when we were kids. And, you know, to not even, you know, let alone be addressing that, but I think this is very much adding to that, because it's instilling in these kids that nature, if we have any sort of problem with it at all, is just there for us to eradicate. Like, we'll just get rid of them. And I think that that's not the message we want to be sending to the next generation. And it definitely makes it harder to talk about this issue with the people that support the events, because it's normalized for them. It's the same way that talking to people about, most people, about eating meat. You know, it's such a normal thing to try to get them to step back and see it as something different is very hard. And also because these events happen in small towns, they don't have a lot going on. They have a huge economic impact.
Oh, yeah, millions of dollars.
For a snake
millions
roundup?
Millions of dollars. Yeah, the population of Sweetwater is around 10,000. They usually get 25,000 to 30,000 visitors to the roundup every year. So it's big. In 2015, they brought in over $8 million to the local economy. So it's a big deal. I recognize that that's a big deal. I'm from a small town myself, and I know that events like that are important. But what's great about this problem, this issue, is that there's a solution that works for everyone. A lot of roundups have evolved, and they're no longer killing animals. They've turned them into wildlife festivals that celebrate and actually teach people about their local wildlife and instill that respect and appreciation. You know, don't involve wild animals at all. They have people bring in captive animals that they use for demonstrations and for education, and they're more successful than ever. They get more visitors. They bring in more money. An actual win-win situation, which you don't often get a clear win-win with environmental or animal issues.
Wow, well, that's hopeful.
Well, I know there used to be one in Alamogordo near us here in El Paso, and I don't know if that rattlesnake roundup is still functioning or not.
No, it went away. I think it was 2006, and it's been a few years, and it was an economic thing. They just weren't, I think, this has happened with a lot of other ones as well. That's the one I'm most familiar with, because that's the closest one to me as well in Arizona. People just weren't coming anymore, I think. So they just weren't bringing in the crowds. It wasn't worth the effort, was my understanding. I think there were some groups in New Mexico that were pushing for that to end, but I think it was mainly in economics. Just, you know, it turns out people aren't into slaughtering wildlife like they used to be, I guess, at least in some parts of the country.
Well, they're not even into going outside anymore, so.
Yeah.
A lot of wildlife are slaughtered indirectly in production of food, as we all know. But other than rattlesnakes, are you working on any other species?
Yeah, the rattlesnake roundup campaign has been our biggest and our first like national campaign. But with the education work, one program that we really want to expand on this year is living with snakes. And a lot of this is rattlesnakes because of where we're located in southern Arizona, and just they're kind of the most difficult in this respect to get people to live. And so this gets at our mission with, you know, wanting people to coexist with snakes. And you brought this up at the beginning with the tailgating. A snake shows up where there are people, and especially if it's a venomous snake, but sometimes even when it's a non-venomous snake, people want it gone. They want it out of their yards. They don't want it near their house. And moving snakes, especially when they're moved great distances, causes problems, not just for that individual snake, although almost certainly for that individual snake, but you get into issues with disease transmission and stuff as well. So we really wanted to develop a packet of resources for individuals and also for groups that normally would do snake translocation to try to help people to live with them, to get them to manage themselves and their pets and their families instead of just moving snakes aside. Because I think we really need to just, in general, as a culture, get away from this moving nature out of our way and learning how to live with instead of live against it. So that's something that I really hope to expand upon this year.
Here we have, at UTEP, we have quite a few researchers that study herps, including snakes. And one of my own doctoral students was looking at the population genetic structure of rattlesnakes here in our area. And, you know, people don't realize, like you said, that these snakes have home ranges. They have groups that they associate with. We also do another professor's group works on a lot of radio telemetry of snakes, looking at their home range, when they're active, when they're not. And this kind of data can help also educate people, like snakes are only active during this time, so if we can just give them space during that time, you know, we don't have to worry about most of the year when they're inactive. You know, things like this can help people understand that they don't always have to be dealing with snakes.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what I've learned through radio tracking and what other people have, too, is that they not only have a home range, but in that home range, they have particular rocks and particular bushes that they go back to year after year in the same place that they use to hunt and they use for shelter. And you can use that when you're living with them. When I was living on a nature preserve that was just loaded with snakes, especially rattlesnakes, you just knew there were some places around the housing that you just don't walk through those bushes because, you know, that's where Double R likes to hang out. Like, that's his spot. If you walk over there, you might step on him. So you tend to avoid it. And because you leave the snakes alone and they've been living there for so long, they avoid hanging out on your walking paths as well because they're terrified of us. Like, to them, we're the threat. We're the predator. And they're more correct than we are in that. And they don't want to run into us either. And so, yeah, that kind of research helps a lot when learning how to live with them, and it's been very helpful.
Well, Melissa, can you tell our listeners where they can learn more about your program?
Yeah, absolutely. So our home on the web is, the web address is a little weird. It's snakes.ngo. And if you want to find out about the Rattlesnake Roundup campaign in particular, that's at rattlesnakeroundups.com. And then you can look for Advocates for Snake Preservation on probably whatever social network you use. We're on most of them.
We've been talking with Melissa Amarello, Director of Education and co-founder of Advocates for Snake Preservation. Thanks so much for being with us on the program, Melissa.
It was great talking to you guys today.